Alright, there's gotta be something on.
They say the word shit like 100 times.
Make the bully drink piss.
Whoa!
What is this exactly about?
Sean's parents are basically on the verge of a divorce.
We'll come back to bite them in the ass later.
I always wonder, like, why was it always that kid's problem?
Did you see that?
But I'm sure if I'm quite drunk enough to see Meet the Beatles.
Of course you didn't. Nobody saw it. You know why? Because no one saw this movie.
It's like Avenue Q, only worse.
Yeah, it was definitely a rental for me.
On 3D, plus the IMAX 3D, plus the other theater had it.
Which was not really that hard.
Wait, where did he come from?
Internet. One of those covers of the video store, you remember?
Oh, this is that movie? Yep, of course. Yep. What in the hell is this and why is it on my TV? Yeah, I'm gonna have to catch this from the beginning.
What am I watching?
Alright, it's 3 a.m. You're flipping around cable, so it must be time to also be listening to What Am I Watching? The movie podcast from the Hollow Knight Network, being hosted by myself, Dave the Clone. Hi, how are you? And joining me tonight on our introspective look, I guess intro and extrospective look, at a...
Down the rabbit hole we go!
I think a modern classic, but Mr. Gomez, not Adams.
Hello!
And it's a bitch, but yes, tonight we are talking about Payback, the 1990 film, directed by...
film.
Did I say 1999?
You said 1990.
Oh, I said 90? I thought 99, and I guess I said 90. Directed by Brian Helgeland, also written by Brian Helgeland, based on the novel The Hunter by Richard Stark. We're talking about the movie Payback, starring Mel Gibson. And we'll be talking about the fact that there are two versions of this film that exist, because you can't talk about one thing without talking about the other, which is from a different movie. Which is from a totally different movie. Anyway, to me, this movie, I don't know, do you remember, like, when you first heard about this movie, or when you first saw this movie?
I think I caught it on cable.
You definitely didn't see it in the theater?
No, this was definitely not a in-the-theater kind of movie.
Hmm. I saw trailers for it in the movies. I remember that.
I mean, I think, because I caught this, this would have come out while I was in college.
Yeah.
So, the only movies I was really catching at that point were the free ones that they would show on campus.
Yeah.
For free.
I remember that.
Which there were some interesting choices that were made.
Scream
2,
man. They showed Scream 2 when I got there.
They showed Trainspotting.
Oh, nice. Very cool. Very cool.
Which, not a movie that you would necessarily think, yeah, let's get a bunch of college kids together and show them this film.
Hey,
kids, heroin is bad.
Don't do heroin. Don't do heroin. But in this, it's don't rob from the Asian mob and then double-cross your friend to buy your way back into the Italian mob. Or, I guess, like a very Americanized mob? Corporate mob?
It's definitely the corporate mob.
It was the Donald Trump mafia.
Oh, only they don't call them the syndicate. They're the outfit now.
The syndicate's old school. It's an old school name for it.
Exactly.
But yeah, so this movie, I remember seeing trailers for it. I think it might have been the last time my mom took my sisters and I to Disney World, and we went to see Mortal Kombat at Pleasure Island, and they showed a trailer for this beforehand. And I remember distinctly the part where he shoots, what's his name, James Coburn's suitcases, and he's like,
yes.
Hey, he's shooting my suits, man. Man, that is mean. Man, that is just mean. And you're like, whoa, this is... I mean, the trailer I posted today on the Facebook page makes this look like a very whimsical movie. You know, like, it almost makes it like a fun action comedy.
And not and discounting even the darker directorial
version
edition of this movie, it is not a lighthearted romp at all.
And even, I mean, the version that's the theatrical version was a very, even thinking it was going to be that lighthearted comedy from the trailer, when you see that movie, it has an intensity. The director's cut has a bit more of an intensity, but in different ways. I actually, after having watched both, prefer the theatrical, now that I think about it. Because I wonder if I had seen the director's first, maybe I'd like that better.
I think my understanding is that the theatrical version shows Porter as more of like the kind of gray character. Like, you actually want to – you can root for him a little bit more. You can get behind what he's out for him anymore. Yeah, he's a thief, but he's got that kind of code.
Mm.
The directorial version, from what I understand, is a much dark – it's very much like the villain protagonist. Like, this is not
hardcore.
Somebody that you ever want to have anything to deal with, ever.
It's – I mean, as it stands, it's a very early instance of anti-hero as the main character of a film for our – modern audience here. But in this version, it felt just more like a regular 90s movie altogether. The fact that the way the theatrical version is presented with this very almost trying to go with like a monochromatic blue filter so that you still see the hints of all the different colors and textures coming through, but everything feels like it's this cool blue, you know, almost Heat-like. Maybe a callback to Michael Mann there.
Which we would see again, I think, in like things like Traffic.
Right. But Traffic, you see, that to me feels so much almost more akin to comic books. Because it's a flat-out, like, almost what it would be like if the whole movie were an old-fashioned Western sepia-toned high shutter speed movie. You know what I mean? Some of the color saturation in Traffic was intense like that.
Absolutely. I mean, Traffic also did it with, you had two separate color saturations going. If you were north of the border, it was all in that blue, washed-out blue.
Right.
Whereas if it was south of the border, it was all that bright yellows and oranges.
And this
really hiding that, bringing out the heat in the film.
And this is supposed to be all in that concrete jungle of the city, you know what I mean?
Very much so. And I guess the theatrical version, you never really get into Porter's head. Because it misses that narration, right?
Well, no, the director's cut doesn't have the narration. The theatrical it's almost like it reminds me of all the different versions of Blade Runner that are out there, mm-hmm. and how there's that one that they're like, oh, the audience won't understand it, so we have to have them explain everything. And, you know, for what it's worth, the way they launch it with the theatrical version, where we open on this big fat guy who's like, he pours a glass of whiskey and drinks it all down in one gulp, and then he pours another one and drops a bunch of scalpels and scissors into it.
Well, and you don't have Obamacare. You get what you get.
Hey. Everything's in predictive programming from the Illuminati, so we're just picking up on it now.
I mean, when you go into the back alley doctor, you can't be that picky.
And, you know, then I think it's kind of warranted because it feels like the old film noir detective movies. You know what I mean? It feels like a Sam Spade adventure over here because it just starts with that voice that GSW, gunshot wound. Hospitals have to report them. And you're just like, okay, so we're in the crime world now, you know? And
that's because you just got shot, and you're using alcohol as your anesthesia to get the bullets out.
/ sterilization agent. You know what I mean? Like, this is what he's sterilizing his instruments with.
Hey, he's bothering to sterilize, though. I mean, you usually got to pay extra for that.
And plus, we know that he survived it because he's telling us the story. And no matter how manipulative and deceptive the advertising campaign was, there's no way we would have mistaken a movie like Fallen, you know what I mean, for Payback. It's like, oh no, is this guy going to jump from body to body demonically? No, it's, you know, he's telling us the story. It's not going to be like, let me tell you about the time I almost died and I'm actually a demon in the cat at the end of the movie. Spoiler alert. For Fallen with Denzel Washington. This one goes
very much like it's very much the crime movie. I mean, we're not going to find anybody coming back from the dead on this one.
Right.
Except unless you want to count, you know,
Porter.
It's Porter in this. Okay.
It is Porter.
Just want to make sure. Because he's got, there's very different versions of this, of the same story I've been told a couple times.
With Parker, right?
Parker in the original. And then they made Jason Statham recently.
So that is kind of like, in a way, almost like a spiritual successor. Like, this movie kicked off a franchise in a way.
Kind of, I think it was more of a remake.
Gotcha. But I like, this one stands on its own anyway.
Absolutely.
And from there, he goes into the opening level of the video game, where you have to just collect as much resources as you can.
Oh, and it's still that sort of, it's very much that film noir or the noir detective story, even though he's the bad guy, not a detective per se.
Right.
He's got to find out, okay, where's my former partner?
But I think even like the streetwise stuff, that whole montage of him like taking money out of the beggar's hat and then like pickpocketing, like picking the right person out of the crowd to pickpocket and then buying a suit. Buying watches, selling the watches for cash and a gun, like eating a meal and skipping out on the bill. And it's like, it was just like all these kind of things that were just like, damn, he went from like shot in the back to, all right, now I'm ready to kick ass. I even have a gun. You know what I mean? Like,
well, you gotta,
ready to roll.
You gotta slowly move up the chain, right?
Now, just to keep track of some differences, director's cut, we don't see him in the back street surgery. It starts with him shambly walking in that first, like, you know, crappy gray suit he has, hearing voiceover of, like, the argument that we get to see later with him and Val that, like, set the whole thing off. Basically, if that's the way we're more in his head in this version, it's that it's totally, like, he's just driven 100% by that incident, you know, so he's hearing the pieces of it again, and then like having kind of flashes at different times of shots from it. Definitely something not in a theatrical version. Again, they're both cool, they both stand on their own, but once there is a point where they both diverge very, very much so towards the end.
Like that's the last act of it, right?
Yeah, the whole final third. I'm like, wow, they showed it. And they must have been like, we don't like it. Go film something new. Get Christopherson.
Actually, what happened? Well, I think that was part of it. Mel Gibson basically, I think, took over a large portion of that production.
Really?
Yes.
All right.
So the whole, I mean, we're just talking about the movie generally. So.
Yeah, sure. So we can jump right to this.
Okay, he gets tortured. Right.
Okay. Well, in the theatrical version, yes.
Right. Exactly. That was never in the director's vision.
Okay, yeah, see, watching the director's cut, I was thinking, okay, so this replaces this whole last thing that happens in the movie, and it has a completely different feel. Like, completely different feel.
Yep, but that was very much, like, Mel Gibson wanted to have the torture scene in there. Continuing my theory that Mel Gibson likes to show him being used as a Christ-like figure and being tortured.
Yeah, I guess if the torture in this did not feel Christ-like at all in my mind.
But in general, he gets.
There's no violence with his wife in the beginning, there's some areas where there's extra dialogue in the director's cut. The director's cut felt very much more like, you know, in the old film noir, nobody was happy. Like, all the women, even the heroine is at some point, or the one that he's trying to save at some point, is, like, broken and tortured and hates him.
Or just is the bad guy in the end.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's like when he first runs into Maria Bello's character in the director's cut, she's happy to see him, but then quickly it goes into like a fight. You know, quickly it's like, well, you left. Why did you leave me? Blah, blah, blah. All right, why don't you get the fuck out of here? And it's just like, whoa, shit. He has a harshness to him that is there in the theatrical version. I'm going to call it the blue version. Because I remember watching it just thinking, like, dude, this guy is so cool and such a badass and so calculating and just, like, confident. I remember even telling Professor Striner at the time, I'm like, you got to watch this. You should probably incorporate this into the curriculum because it's a totally modern film noir. And I think he enjoyed it, but
I'm not sure if I'd say that would be the best example of a noir film.
No, he wanted,
even from the time period.
I mean, I feel like it's a campy noir, you know what I mean? Like, with the voiceover, the monochromatic, the cops all being crooked, and everybody being out for themselves and part of everything, you know, it's, and him being able to operate the way he does. You know, he has, like, almost a divine protection about him, the way he just kind of smooths his way through this whole movie.
But I think a film like Miller's Crossing is even a better example, though.
Sure, yeah.
If you're gonna need to pick one,
but it's also got that Coen quirkiness to it that kind of makes it it's too modern to be just noir. I mean, when I told Striner about it, he said in his mind the movie Twilight with Paul Newman was a very much more of a modern noir film, which I never wound up watching, so I can't really comment. But
I would go out there and say L.A. Confidential.
Yeah, L.A. Confidential. I mean, I don't feel like it needs to be a period piece either, but L.A. Confidential definitely was a very, I mean, captured that feel completely.
Very much so.
And I felt like this was that same way, just with a modernized story. And instead of a detective or a cop being the hero, we have the anti-hero of a crook done wrong who is just trying to get back what's his. Not even what's being offered to him, just what's his, what he wants, what he feels like was taken from him.
I mean, but I also feel like this movie didn't need necessarily, it's kind of timeless in the setting.
Mm. So you've
got the old school hotel kind of. Nobody's carrying around a cell phone.
Yeah, true, true.
Imagine how much different it would be if people were.
Well, I think the car phone at the end, right? That's like the closest to the mobile technology that was going on at that point.
Yep.
I mean, and maybe they did that for effect, you know what I mean?
But even, I mean, all those, I mean, if you look at the phones that are being used in this, they're all corded phones.
True. And then the speaker is the old boxy speaker, like, from the 70s. Like, when you put on speakerphone, it's just some thing on the desk that's emitting sound, you know?
I mean, the most modern thing of this might be Lucy Liu's character.
True, with the dominatrix.
Yeah.
And and how they really kind of play the whole cultural clash there too, because all the Caucasian and American women are either victims or former victims who've become strong, or junkies or prostitutes. Whereas like in the Asian, like she's part of the mob. She actually turns out to be like in charge of the shit after a while.
She's the only one that survives.
Yeah, he like leaves her be, and it's like they have this weird pseudo sexual pull towards each other that the power attracts, or at least for her.
Well, she likes, I mean, she gets off on the pain. I mean, she's got both sides of the coin.
Yeah, but I think it's also how powerful he was, too. Because, she was just like, hey, I've got a few minutes. I don't think she was planning on beating him up. She was just going to be like, you can fuck me. You're allowed to fuck me. Everybody else has to beat me, and I beat them up.
He's just like, you know what? You're a little too crazy for me.
Go boil an egg. I love his line. His dialogue in this movie was so awesome. This was like, I'm like, I fucking want to be Porter, man. And again, very much a John Wick, too. Like, he takes down a whole friggin' syndicate in this movie.
it's the same kind of like, there's this whole underworld out there. I mean, we see more of the police in this, I feel. Mm-hmm. And they're very much, there's no good character in this. Like, the closest you get to a good policeman is Internal Affairs investigating the dirty cops.
Yeah. I mean, everybody does the passive-aggressive thing to a T. You know, like Bill Duke and his partner, who was also in L.A. Confidential. Let's find out that actor's name. It's probably right next to Bill Duke. Why can't I find Bill Duke? There he is. All right, well, it's not David Paymer, and it's definitely not John Glover or William Devane.
Jack Conley.
Right after Lucy Liu on IMDb. Dudes, do you guys know? It's like they fucking listen. It's like this website's like, all right, he's going to go down the list. Let's just keep moving this shit so he can't see it. Fuck you. William Devane. I bet you think it's William Devane, don't you?
But
know?
It's not William Devane. That's Carter.
That's Carter. What the hell was Detective Leary? We didn't even know. I didn't even know that guy's friggin' name.
Hey.
Detective Hicks is Bill Duke, and I mean, he was the one like, oh yeah, we can't help you. It would be against the law. You know, like that whole, that passive aggressive, like you just feel like, oh man, if this was me in that situation, I'd be so pissed off. And Porter is just like cooling his way through, you know, like,
I fuck you guys over, just not right at the moment.
He's all about that, too. It's all about, like, understand the importance of each moment, which I think that's why when you think about it being based on a book called The Hunter, you know, it is all about waiting and picking that right moment, you know? I mean, so the whole idea is that he was double-crossed in a robbery that he and his buddy Val pulled off on the Asian mob in town, basically stealing their weekly payroll in a way devised by Mel Gibson, actually.
Yeah, but he realized that the payroll delivery guys were not wearing seat belts. And so let's stage a head-on collision.
Very much, I'm sure, inspiring Grindhouse's Death Proof a couple years down the road there. But yeah, they wind up swindling a bunch of cash, and they were expecting like $500,000, and it turns out that they only stole $140,000. And surprise, surprise, it's always $140,000, and Val knew that because this is his friend played by Greg Henry. Val needed to pay back the syndicate at that time, which when Porter would come back, it would be called the outfit. Although, now that I mention that, I'm sort of confused on the timeline here. How long is Porter away, like, healing from these gunshot wounds?
Yeah, I don't think it's ever really said. It's also not really said when that transition was made, if it was done actually before that, because you get the feeling that Porter here, I mean, he is a lone operator.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, he's not working for any group. He's not after, he's not an employee.
He's freelance.
He's a freelance operative.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of the way he likes it.
And he's a high-end thief, so it's like he's not even a murderer for hire kind of freelancer. He's literally, he'll devise the way. Now, I don't know that this car crash, it didn't put him in the same class as, like, De Niro's Neil McCauley from Heat,
yes,
or even his character in Heist, where it was like, let's put the water in the safe, and that's how we get the safe open. It's just that he is that cool, can read the moment, figure out what to do, and do it. And so for him, they saw the guys drive by, we're going to crash into these guys. Only, and his wife was the getaway driver after right. They crashed their car, came and picked them up. And then she winds up shooting him in the back, and because, apparently Val showed her a photograph that she didn't like seeing.
Yeah, well, you never want to see your guy dancing with another blonde.
Even if it did eventually turn out to be before they had ever met.
Doesn't matter.
Which is not said in the theatrical version, but is said in the director's cut.
Well, Val also kind of played up, like, Val's the one that showed the picture and played up. This is what happened.
Yeah. Or I think
this is what's going on with your husband and this other woman. And that's why she ends up shooting him.
Yeah. Or at least along with Val's plan. Yeah. And again, this must be long enough time between where he gets shot and left for dead and recovers and comes back. Because when he does come back, she is a pretty far gone heroin addict.
Yeah. She went down quickly.
The guilt. I mean, you could see from the moment this happened, like when they're in the heist, she's kind of having that shut down, freeze kind of a breakdown where she just shot him and now she's almost borderline catatonic. And Val had to, like, okay, it's okay. All right, just like we planned, let's get in the car, let's get ready to go. And then he was taking care of the whole, like, making sure we got the money. Take the gun, puts out his cigarette in Mel Gibson's blood, you know?
Yeah! Classy stuff.
Insult to injury.
Just in case you didn't realize that he was an asshole.
Yeah, yeah, it's bad. It's all bad. And then, so by the time Porter comes back, the first place he goes is to his wife. After, I mean, like, the montage of him getting the suit and getting back to Porter level is pretty impressive. You feel bad for a lot of people that he runs into in the city.
Somewhat.
It suddenly makes me very conscious of everybody walking around in New York. And I'm like, I must have that look where I'm just trucking so hard and so, like, fast walking that people are like, you know, no, we're not trying to fuck with that guy. That guy literally, that's like stepping onto a freight train, you know, it's like, nope.
Then you worry about, you know, when you're standing still on a subway.
Exactly. What's it called? So he goes to his wife and basically, in the theatrical version, she kind of, like, he just puts her to bed, right? Like, he kicks the door in, that kind of knocks her out. He clears the place, and then he puts her to bed. in the director's cut, he like they fist fight. Like they like she even comes at him with a knife that she grabs from the kitchen countertop.
Great. It's like a little bit of domestic violence.
It's insane. Like it's almost like I'm like, "Oh, trying to make your mark, first time director. I got it. I got it." Throwing her so that she skids across the floor. Damn. And then she's even saying shit like, "Where's your whore? Did you bring your whore with you?" And he shows the picture and goes, "This was before you and I even met." And she, like, and, you know, you could see that she, like, kind of started to understand right when he said that. And he, like, he tells the story of how he meets, how he met Rosie.
Rosie.
And she winds up telling that story later to, who does she tell? Who is she talking to? Don't they have another friend helping them?
Not really. Not in the theatrical, at least.
Fuck. Well, I forget. How do we find out the story of Rosie in the theatrical?
Well, they basically talk to each other. I mean, she because he used to drive for her.
Yeah.
Okay, when she was not working for the outfit or the syndicate.
He was providing her a safe environment to work in.
Precisely. And that's all it was. And at some point, he comes out like, well, you know, why didn't you just keep driving? Like, why did you not? Why'd you drop me off at the client instead of, you know, taking me off to someplace by just you?
Well, that's, he leaves her. The day they sleep together, when they finally sleep together once, then he can't take it anymore.
Right.
Because she said, you know, why didn't you ask me to quit? And he goes, why didn't you ask me to drive you somewhere else? It was like both, like she said, she's like, did you leave after we slept together? Is that what happened? And he goes, nope, I didn't decide then. I decided the next day when I had to take you to work. You know, so it's like, it's one of those things. And that it's like, yeah, when we're watching the movie, yeah, dude, she looks great right now. We're supposed to all be like, oh, look, Maria Bello, this is amazing. But, like, think about what the story you just heard was. Like, yeah, dude, I would wait in the car while she went in and fucked somebody. Then she'd come out. I'd drive her to the next one. This was all day. This was every day. And then somehow, one random drunk night, it was me for free. That was when the real person came out, and we fell in love, and then the next day, I couldn't even stomach it.
Or at least strong lost, you know, might.
Oh, my God. And that's when she wound up going to the outfit.
Right, exactly. Or look for a little bit down the line, because you get the feeling that the outfit's really getting its fingers in everything at this, mm-hmm. at this point. And that was actually kind of Val's thing, too. Like, he wanted to get into the outfit. And that $140,000 was his way in.
Well, it was his way in slash, I mean, Carter positions it as he was repaying a debt. Because now the whole time Porter's mission, he's just telling everybody, I want my $70,000. I want the $70,000 that was mine from that half of the take. And everywhere he goes, like the first person he hits up is young Freddy Rodriguez playing the delivery guy.
Wasn't that also the wife's... dealer?
Yeah, delivery guy slash heroin right. dealer.
Yep.
Who would later be making it big on, oh, I don't know, what was it, 6 Feet Under? Was that his show? God damn it, IMDb. Like, you really suck. You really suck. Where is he?
I'm sorry, who was it?
Freddy Rodriguez, who is also in...
the punk... cast is Punk Messenger.
Is that, where is that? Where are you?
Oh, yeah, Matt Speedunder, also known, and he was also in Planet Terror in Harsh Times.
And with the movie that's on in the background right behind me right now, The Lady in the Water. He's the stupid guy who's only working out half his body.
He's also done a bunch of voice work, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, he was in, like, Can't Hardly Wait. He's definitely got, like, a face everybody
wants. Oh, that guy, yeah. Wanted to punch him.
And, in this, you want to punch him even more. But this is the first time we get that, worry about me, what do you think I'm going to do to you? You know, like, yeah. He pulls the guy in, like, you know, first the guy, like, you know.
You're going to kill me.
And this is Deborah Kara Unger, right? Please tell me I remembered this one. Is that Mrs. Porter, Mrs. Lynn Porter, Deborah Kara Unger? Thank fucking God. He's expecting Deborah Kara Unger to open the door, and instead Mel Gibson opens the door in his boxers and you know, a wife beater, and he's like, oh, is Miss Porter here? And he's like, Mrs. Porter. Yeah.
At that point, I think I would have just been like, you know what? Wrong door.
Yeah. My mistake, bro. My mistake. Instead, he's like, whatever, and like gets pulled in by his dread locks. And that's the other thing too. Like, no matter which version of this movie you're watching, how quickly it goes from calm to violent. You know what I mean? Like within like, oh, like okay, that's it. You said the wrong thing. Mel Gibson's gonna kill you now. I mean, that guy was pissing blood at the very least as soon as this is all over, because he hit him with, like...
At the least. Well, I think in the director's version, he, like, coughs blood, and that's where it ends.
Yeah, he like, hits him with at least 10 kidney punches, you know what I mean? Like, yeah,
it's just, dude, you need medical treatment, and don't go back to the back alley doc.
Yeah.
The actual, real medical treatment.
It's bad. It's bad. Like,
and you haven't been shot, so they don't have to report it.
Now, this is later when he comes back to Mariabella, too. It's the same thing. She's like, you need a doctor. And he's like, nah, I'm fine. It's like, and that's, too. The other thing about it, he's got that sort of, like, hero unkillability. Like, it's like, almost like a hero impenetrability to pain.
Oh, yeah, I mean, he gets hit by a car.
Yeah, like, and just, like, walks away from it. You know what I mean? He gets roughed up a little bit throughout. Especially, like, he would have been killed by the Asian mob if the cops didn't come along. And then the cops, see, that's the thing. I just watched the director's cut. Almost everybody he runs into beats the shit out of him a little bit. And it's in that way, very much like Miller's Crossing. I mean, even, don't they call him the human punching bag in Miller's Crossing? It's like,
I think so.
And it's kind of the way, but it's also kind of the only way to survive these types of situations, apparently. And I think that's also supposed to show us that he is strong enough for when we get to the torture sequence later. Because that's, like, I mean, he loses toes.
Yeah, that was just...
And not, like, by cut off, like, smashed with a ball-peen hammer, loses toes. Like, oh. Even, I think Chris Christopherson says they're starting to look like roast beef. And you're like, aw.
And he doesn't even want to even have anything to deal with it. He's like, I don't want to torture you.
Shit.
Don't make me do that. But it's ugly.
And that's the other thing, too. It's the fact that he's got this level of audacity. All the upper crust mafia guys are, like, impressed. You know what I mean? They're impressed, but they're also, like, getting outplayed, like, because of his bluntness.
It's like, we are willing to give you your money. Just go away. I mean, that would kind of been the smart thing to do. In a certain
I was
going to
say, well, that's actually what they weren't willing to do.
Wouldn't that have been the smart, like, dude, here's your $140,000, $70,000, whatever. Take the money, go away.
I mean, honestly, yeah, when you think about what they're paying, they have an entire hotel that is all outfit people. Who knows if they actually rent any of the rooms to normal, regular paying customers just to supplement. You know what I mean? Can you imagine, like, now when I check into hotels, I am assuming that some of it is mafia rooms. I mean, I'm guessing probably not so much at, like, the Marriott or, like, you know, a Holiday Inn, something that's, like, a big chain. That's
just
for the public.
All the time you go to Vegas.
That's for the public. But all these other places, yeah, Vegas or any of these hotels that are like this one where it was, like, the Oakwood Arms. You know, like, okay, maybe, like...
It's like you're not owned by a chain.
Right. Is it, like, 80% mob in there and, like, 20% open to the public, and it's only to, like, the wealthy 1%, you know? It's like Trump has a penthouse there. And
Or is it just, you know, like in John Wick, where they had the whole...
That is exactly what it made me think of.
The Continental.
Yeah, the Continental. John Wick is, like, a much more serious... Although, this was pretty serious. It just
this
had
is
a little
serious.
Bit...
I mean, John Wick, in a lot of ways, is like, the next level up from this.
Yeah, yeah.
Because here, at least, I mean, you still have police presence.
They're right.
They're cops, but they're still something of a presence.
And he Porter becomes intimidating to people who don't know him. John Wick is, like, a living legend,
well,
so...
And the other difference, I mean, that is... And he's getting played up. He's like, Porter's not a contract killer.
Right.
He's a
true
thief.
True. But he's a, like, I mean.
He's a cold-blooded thief. Absolutely.
Yeah. His street training was enough that he knows killing is part of the deal.
Well, you also know that, did you catch the USMC?
Yes, yes.
Tattoo that he's got. So, I mean, there's definitely that. I mean, never gets talked about, but there's definitely that sense that, you know, Porter probably had some training back in the day.
And I'm sure that that's a lot of where the, what do you think I'm going to do? Worry about me. Like when the guy's like, I can't tell you, man, they'll kill me. He's like, what do you think I'm going to do? He's like, I'm here with a gun to your head right now. You know what I mean? Like, worry about me.
Exactly.
And it's, he's not, he says that to both Freddy Rodriguez and then he says it to Val right before he kills him. Cause he's like, you know, it's the point where he's like, look, you're a human being. I shot a hole in you. Everything hurts. All I have to do is apply a little pressure. You're going to realize pain is pretty bad. And you know, tell me what the fuck I want to know. What do you care if you're gonna live through this or not? Like right now, you're just gonna be in pain until you tell me, and then you're probably gonna want me to kill you because if I don't, they will. Whoever you told on, they'll come and fucking kill you.
I'll do it faster than they will.
Yeah, I'm just gonna put a pillow over your face and put a gun into the pillow and pull the trigger.
Besides,
it's pretty fucking humane when you think about it, man. Like, for God's sake, you won't even know where the bullet's coming from except for somewhere in the big gray in front of you. Whatever, just shut your fucking mouth and die.
And that's what you get for when you go after my girl.
Yes.
And shoot the dog that was named after me.
Both of them. You turn my wife into a junkie, you know what I mean? Like, you beat my girlfriend.
You try to kill the dog.
That's it. Two steps too far.
Not smart. Not smart at all.
And I like that Maria Bello's character, who is Rosie, so, you know, the story being that Porter, when he first got out of prison, started driving for Rosie to provide a safe environment for her to work, and that was kind of what he did for a living. And then they fell for each other a little bit, and he had to leave her. And then I guess we just assume some point between there and where we pick up the story, he became this awesome, badass, highline thief.
And he eventually married Mrs. Porter.
And wound up becoming friends with Val. So, I mean, there's prequel all over this right here, you know?
For certain definitions of friend, because you get the feeling that Val was never somebody that you actually wanted to be around.
Yeah.
Absolutely had to.
And it's almost like, I wonder why Porter was even involved with this guy in the first place. But
sometimes for certain jobs, you need a partner.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you wind up like, hey, man, this one went pretty well. Why don't we do a couple more, you know? Yeah. And he becomes kind of like a knockoff Gary Busey, you know, like a knockoff younger Gary Busey. Sorry, Greg Henry or Henry Gregg. What was your fucking name?
Grandpa from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Greg Henry. He is? No
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, at the beginning of the Guardians of the Galaxy. He was.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot. He walked in there real quick. Yeah, and I guess we should mention some of the other characters that we have in this movie. We mentioned Freddy Rodriguez. We mentioned Deborah Kerr Unger playing Lynn Porter, Maria Bello playing Rosie, David Paymer as Arthur Stegman, the bookie.
Stegman.
Awesome.
The butt monkey of this film.
Yeah, I mean, like, geez. You know, he almost has, like, an Igor in Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein feel to his character. You know, sort of like, not really 100% knows what's going on, but knows enough to be involved. Always gets himself into deeper shit, you know, always getting deeper and deeper, thinking he's got the upper hand. I mean, in the trailer, we even see the spot where he pulls a gun on Porter and Porter just takes the gun away from him. Like,
yes.
And then he goes, Jesus, man, you're not going to fucking kill me, are you? You know, it's like, dude.
Even his end is ignoble because he gets to get used as a human shield.
It's badass. He gets riddled like Sonny Corleone, man. And he's screaming the whole time. It's a little more graphic in the director's cut, but at least it's still there.
I mean, the other thing I noticed was like, everybody in this film insists on holding their gun sideways.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Understand
that was a very 90s thing, though. Everybody was exploring that street look of like, yo, and it's like everybody even says like this actually decreases your accuracy by so much. You know what I mean? Like,
increases the chance of it jamming.
It increases the jam, decreases your accuracy, and is just stupid.
And I'm sorry, but this film is way too white for that look.
Yeah, although it's at least there is some diversity to the cast.
Yes, you got Lucy Liu in the tong, and you do have a couple of African American. You've got a
Bill Duke. As we mentioned earlier. Shit, though, you know what? This is so John Wick because we had that same criticism of John Wick. It's like it's a very light cast, John. It's a little, I mean, I don't know if Eastern European counts as diversity right now.
No, not really.
You know what I'm saying? Like, maybe you should go South African, and maybe.
Maybe.
Get something going on there.
I mean, what do you guys tell me? Porter definitely also has a type in this film. Like, yeah. He likes the thin and blonde.
Right. And I mean, that's, again, back to noir. It's a little tropey. You know, but it's also New York. It's melting pot. There could have been probably. And I think it's not like we don't see in the theatrical. They go to a boxing match. So there's a big crowd of people, lots of different diversity represented there. And there was that. So there's that whole subplot. Bronson's son.
Johnny.
Hey, Johnny. Hold on a second, Fairfax. Hey, Johnny. Got you this present for you. You go have a good time tonight. It's like, oh, Dad, really, Dad? You got me a car? Dad! No way! Thank you!
And Johnny's not too bright, though.
Yeah, that's what happens. And Johnny and two friends wind up in a limousine where Rosie is waiting for them, thinking that...
Rosie's waiting outside saying, I'm here for you, the other part of Johnny's.
Oh, this is at the end, right after they get out of the fight,
and she starts hitting on him a little bit, but just long enough to handcuff him in the car.
Yeah, but they're all like, "Oh man, that's awesome, dude! You have a good night, man. We'll see you later." And it's like
much later.
Your dad must have set this up, sweet hookers. You know, and I'm like, all right, we're done.
And he's left, and the best part is they just leave him in the motel.
Yeah, he has no idea what's going on.
And no way to call for help. And, yeah, he's going to be having a good time.
But at least they didn't kill him. Because they kill everybody else. They kill everybody else. I guess at what point did they plant the bomb in his hotel room? Before this, because...
It was after he kills Val.
All right, yeah, so he winds up killing Carter. He winds up killing Val. But this is, like, the famous, like... Like, Carter calls the boss. He says, I've got a man in my office who's threatening to kill me for $130,000. Like, no, $70,000. No one's listening to me. Now, in the theatrical version, he calls Kris Kristofferson, right?
I believe so.
In the director's cut, Bronson is a female's voice that we never meet.
Okay.
But it's all exactly the same dialogue that Kris Kristofferson has. It's just that they added in all the stuff with Johnny.
Okay.
So we basically hear this phone call, and that was basically what I was doing during the director's cut, going like, oh, so this is Kris Kristofferson, all this exact same dialogue. And then the same thing again when he then goes to James Coburn's house, because he does, in fact, kill Carter. Carter. Because Bronson thought he was bluffing. And once he realizes that it's serious, it's like, you know, you just signed your own death warrant, don't you? Yeah. It's like, I'll see you in a little while.
You're acting like I have not heard that before.
Come on. I know, right? Like, it's just a different version of John Wick. It's like, that's what it is. That's
very
what
much. Only having a slightly better motivation. It wasn't just like, you killed my dog while I was in my grieving process, and now I must take that grieving process out on you.
This is like, you shot me in the back and left me for dead, but you didn't kill me. Dumb fucking mistake on your part.
And I want my money.
You motherfuckers.
Give me my fucking money. Like, John Wick has no concept of money.
And
does not give a shit about money.
And no dialogue either, for the most part. He's just like a moving specter, like a ghost just killing everybody.
And John Wick does not need to level up.
Right.
Okay, he just goes down to his basement, grabs a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
Tears up the floor. It's like, oh, look, my guns. Oh, my beautiful guns.
So I almost think of John Wick as Porter's illegitimate son. You know what I mean? Like, Rosie had a kid that she didn't tell Porter about. And then he went and became John Wick.
Angel of death.
eventually could take down the entire Russian syndicate. I'm trying to think. So once they have Johnny, that's like their sort of that's their safety net to be able to get Bronson and all the other people that go to his hotel room, I guess, to look for Johnny.
Yeah, that was. I mean, they really were after getting him to be. They wanted to get Bronson out,
right,
into the open, and. Unfortunately for Porter, that's how that happens.
Yeah, so he wound up being smart enough to not fall for this booby trap where they planted like an explosive under the bed that if you answer the phone it would explode. But he was also smart enough to leave it there and remember it was there. So yep. He basically set a big trap for the bad guys. And when they left him beat up in the trunk, he found a way to, like, you know, break through the back seat of the car and get to the front of the car seat to use the car phone to call the apartment while they're up there. And kaboom, they get away with so much.
Answering the phone is what triggers the bomb.
And they get away with killing the mob and keeping their money.
Absolutely. And leaving Johnny handcuffed to a radiator in some seedy motel.
Yeah. Now, in the director's cut, we don't get some of that awesome cinematic, like the explosions. You know, like there's two scenes in this movie where he just blows shit up. There's one scene where John Glover, who is one of Carter's best hitman fixer, Ray Donovan
in the
types,
car when he cuts the fuel line.
And they're the ones that planted that bomb in Porter's hotel room. So Porter, like, finds the bomb and then looks out the window and sees their car, sneaks down, cuts the fuel line, and just stands there and waits for them to notice him in the rearview mirror. And as they do, he drops his cigarette, and we get that sort of almost slow walk away, except it's him just standing there watching the shit happen.
Yep.
Blows that car all to hell. In the director's cut, John Glover, we're not sure if he's dead or not. There's this whole, I mean, everything goes down so differently in the director's cut.
Sure.
Like, the director's cut, he tells Bronson, he gives them, like, sort of like a meet at this train platform at this location and have somebody bring the money in a blue backpack. And they still send a shit ton of people, you know, but sure. he goes and gets the drop on everybody, and he, like, you know, takes one out. He gets him to tell him where the other guys are hidden for him, but more waves come, and he eventually does find the guy with the blue backpack, and he gets the money, but he winds up getting shot, like, right in the stomach. Like, he totally gets gut shot. He kills takes that last hit while he's killing everybody. And then when he comes down the stairs, because it's an elevated train, John Glover's in a car with his other two hitmen, and they're like, Jesus, he's still alive. Like, I can't believe it. And he's, like, all, like, you know, disheveled and walking around, like, he looks like he's about to die, but he then quickly, like, spurts off five shots, and he hits the first guy who gets out of the car in the head, and then another one goes through the windshield, and it looks like it hits John Glover, but he, like, covers his face and is like, like, if he got hit in the head, he'd be dead. So right, maybe sure. he's not dead. And they drive away, and then he just, like, sits on the ground and is gonna die, and now we get, like, the camera doing a 360 around him, and he's having flashes to all these other moments from earlier in the movie in black and white, and he's just gonna sit there and smoke a cigarette and die. And then Rosie comes and smacks him, wakes him up, and throws him in the car, and they drive away happily ever after. No explosion, no getting Bronson. I'm wondering if they, because I think wasn't there a series of novels by Richard Stark?
Yes.
So maybe they were trying to leave the door open to do more.
It's possible. Because I think Bronson ends up not getting killed, like, until two books after this.
Oh, really?
These events, yeah. Like, eventually Porter does go after the syndicate, but it's not until much, much later.
So they kind of compressed what became the theatrical version. They kind of compressed that story a bit to bring in the death of Bronson early. Yep. Well, you know what? I mean, even not really knowing at the time that I saw this movie that it was based on a series of novels, I think as a standalone movie, this thing was awesome.
Oh, absolutely.
And now, like, it flies under the radar. You find it in the bargain bins. And
I mean, if you're looking for a good noir film, this one's a good one to get into.
It's a starter noir. It's
very
a
much
starter
so.
Modern noir.
It does not have the complexity of an L.A. Confidential.
Right.
It's not as dark as some of the other noir films that you could find out there. It's also a little bit closer to what I would consider classic noir than, say, like a John Wick.
Oh, yeah.
Because John Wick is very much the sort of, like, I'm going to rip through the criminal underground. I'm a little bit more like a comic book character than I am about anything resembling a real human being.
Yeah.
Because here he goes and he's very much the dented iron kind of character. But he's still evidently human. I mean, he definitely bleeds. He definitely slows down a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But he, you know, he gets the job done.
Yeah. I mean, I think it also is a very, like, it's almost like a trope study for the noir genre.
Oh,
you know?
Absolutely.
Like, and so, for anyone who's, like, less familiar with noir, it's a good starter piece because it kind of gets you used to, like, there's no one to trust. You know, even the damsel in distress could be untrustworthy. And in the director's cut, it looked like at one point when he asked her where the hotel was or where Val was, she was like, I'm an employee of the syndicate as well. So I don't know if they would, you know, they might frown on me giving you that information. And then what happens if they catch you? Because I don't know if you're strong enough to take all of them on. And then she gets all pissed at him. And it's almost like, oh, shit, is he going to fight with her again now? Like... Like, I thought this was the love interest. In the theatrical, the gray or the blue version, it's like, it's all mellow. Like, they see each other and it's all awesome again. Like, you never kind of feel any animosity from Porter towards any of the female characters, even and especially not Lucy Liu. You know, it's only after the Tong try to kill him that last time that they both, like, pull the trigger and their guns are empty and then they just walk away, you know? In the director's cut version, it's very much more like everybody in this criminal underground
everybody's
is like
out against everybody else.
Yeah, there's no honor among thieves, and you know what? It doesn't matter. You're my wife. You fucking shot me in the back. I'm throwing you on the fucking ground. And it seemed like he didn't want to, or he wouldn't have hit Rosie, but it almost seemed like she was going to start hitting him.
Right.
And then they do show in the director's cut, like where they start like making out like there's gonna be a sex scene almost, and then he suddenly's like, I got stuff to do.
Yeah, she been about a dog.
Basically, yeah, got some stuff to do, so I'll be back.
Zach,
yeah,
can't be distracted right now.
Payback's a bitch, man, especially when it's Porter.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was good. I love this movie.
It's definitely one to keep on if you catch it at 2 a.m.
Yeah. And it's almost like, I guess we now definitely have to move on to Gross Point Blank, because that's what these movies are. It's about these kinds of people who have this just like...
Well, the original adaptation, there was a movie adaptation of this before...
Of The Hunter?
Of Payback. Of The Hunter, called Point Blank.
Yes.
Which
I was like, oh, so is that what the title of Gross Point Blank is supposed to be a little bit of a callback to?
It is.
Oh, no shit. Look at this. You're also finding Dave figuring stuff out live on the air for the first time.
There you go.
How lucky for all of you at home.
His Gross Point is a suburb of Detroit.
And is Detroit where Point Blank takes place?
And that's it. That is because it has to deal with the car manufacturing.
God
and whistleblowers.
Nice.
A lot of people are like, wait, why is he going out and killing these people?
A canary decided to sing. Oh my god.
Exactly.
Oh my god.
And the girlfriend's dad was one of the whistleblowers, and that's why he has the contract on him.
Yep.
Which he doesn't open up until it's almost too late.
Yeah. Oh my god. Oh, I love it. I love it. Oh, so now I want Porter, and I want, what's his name in Gross Point Blank?
Martin Blank
and John Wick to all go, like, wind up on vacation together at the same place. You know what I mean?
I will stay far, far away from there.
And they're all wind up going after the same, like, their version of Spectre. You know what I mean?
My money's on Wick.
Of course. But Porter will keep coming back every time they think he's dead. You know what I mean? Like, he'll get shot and he'll just come back. And they'll be like, Porter, why didn't you pick up the bags, man? There was like millions of dollars there. He's like, because they only needed 70,000. 70,000. I don't need million. Why am I
here? And John Wick's like, money? I don't need money. What do you? It's like, no, give me the gold coins.
John Wick's like, I'll call for reservation for 12. Oh my god. All right, well, maybe that'll be an iconic moments of movie history coming out for you. But I think that's going to...
Hit on vacation.
Yeah, right. Oh, shit, that's exactly it. All right, that's it. We're getting into pre-production on that one right now. But I hope you've enjoyed our little romp through Payback. Maybe we'll add this to the list of ones we're going to cite for syncable commentaries. If you don't know what that means, just stay tuned. You will find out soon enough. But any final words on Payback?
I don't think so at this point. Again, I hope you, if you do check it out, I hope you enjoy it. But, you know, I can understand where some people might think, you know what, maybe not my cup of tea.
Yeah, but it's worth a try. I'd say give that theatrical version a twirl, and then if nothing else,
Lucy Liu and Dom Deere.
Yes, for real. Some stuff like that is worth taking note of. And you know what? If you liked the, and then if you liked the blue version, I'd say check out what the director's cut, which is called Straight Up, Payback, Straight Up.
Which came out like almost like 7 years after everything else did.
And I think it may have actually even been one of the movies that Microsoft was trying to hang their hat on to try to push the survival of HD DVD, which is the format I watched it in for prep for today's podcast, because I own an HD DVD player. So there.
Hey.
And I'll tell you, it's a damn clear picture, man. It's pretty impressive. So, yeah. Until next time, I know you've all been enjoying our back-to-school programming with some shows like, oh, I don't know, Real Genius and Weird Science. Still might be some back-to-school stuff kind of on the horizon, because once the school year starts, it's open season on anything school-related, so keep your ears peeled for that. But till then, we may be flipping to another couple types of movies, like, I don't know, war movies, or, hey, even Halloween-y sort of horror-type movies. So, yeah, just keep flipping, and we'll keep dipping. Until then, I'm Dave the Clone.
And I am Gomez Nut Adams.
And this has been... What has this been?
Oh! What am I watching?
Payback.
What am I watching?
That's right.
You've been listening to the Hollow Nine Network, bringing you the very best in fan-made media. Follow us on Twitter at Hollow9Cast. That's Hollow, the number 9, I-N-E, cast. Email us at Hollow9Podcast@gmail.com. Or find us at our home site, Hollow9.podomatic.com. Be sure to check out our affiliate, Fangirlzone.com. Find us on Facebook. Rate and review us on iTunes. Join in the fun. Hollow9.